LaserDisc Vault is over 25,000 LaserDiscs in stock at great low prices. From horror, cult, exploitation to silent era and Criterion films, they have everything a real collector is looking for. They also offer rare out-of-print LaserDisc to DVD transfers, matting and framing services, and other laser supplies. LaserDiscVault.com can handle all your LaserDisc needs. Check them out at LaserDiscVault.com or over on Facebook. And because you're here to hear first, take 25% off everything in their store with the Mondo Film Podcast coupon code LDVMV. Again, that's LDVMV. Please visit LaserDiscVault.com today.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin from
Mondo.
Welcome to the fourth episode of the Mondo Film Podcast. I'm your host, film writer Justin Bozon, a.k.a. Mondo Justin. I'm joined again this week for our third show dedicated to the very underrated Kim Darby by the co-creator, co-host of the best film podcast in existence, The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, The Samurai. How's it going this week, man?
Sally.
Oh, it's going good, man. How you doing?
Good. So this week we're taking a look back at the 1973 made-for-television horror classic Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. You know, the film is a nail-biting tensioner which sees a young married couple moving into an old mansion that they inherit, which just so happens to also be occupied by little demonic creatures. Now, these demonic creatures, once unleashed, they set out to get our film's heroine, Sally, played frighteningly wonderful by Kim Darby, and drag her down to their hell, which just so happens to have its gateway via the old unused fireplace in the basement. Here's the audio trailer for the film.
ABC presents Wednesday Movie of the Week.
Kim Darby has inherited this house from her grandmother, but the house has some secrets.
What's this?
It's for cleaning out the ashes.
It's been bolted shut.
By me. And that's the way it should stay.
I think we have visitors.
Visitors?
Mice. I thought I saw something in the kitchen. But it was something like this little ferocious animal grabbed at my dress.
We want you, Sally.
Don't be afraid of the dark.
So, Sam, you know, why don't you kick it off this week? You know, I wanted to see if you could think back. I mean, you know, this is a horror film that has such a special spot in the hearts of so many fans. You know, I was curious to see if you could recall the first time you saw the film and at what age. And, you know, did it have an impact on you? And what was that impact?
Okay, yeah. I first saw Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the original film. Let's make sure we always get that out there. I first saw it, I guess, around the age of about – I think I was about 12 or 13. I was a little older because I had to wait for video on this one. Not video, but I had to wait for cable, I should say. And it just popped up sometime on cable. Because, you know, these TV films that were made in the 70s, I was actually born in 73. So, I mean, there's no way I was going to see this thing in 73. You know, that would have been a pretty amazing feat.
Right.
But my mom and dad always, I do have a good story about this one. My mom and dad always told me about this film, saying it's really, really creepy and really scary. My mom and dad always liked to turn me on to horror films. They were very cool about that growing up. Charles Bronson films, horror films. They were very open-minded when it came to film. And they would always tell me about this because I was always like, you know, I like scary movies, and, you know, and I would always talk it up. And then some of these movies they would show me, I'd be so scared I'd end up going in the other rooms. Like, I can't watch this. But they always said Don't Be Afraid of the Dark was like one of the scariest movies they'd ever seen. So finally, we got a hold of it. It wasn't at a video store. It was a copy from somebody. This is back in the day when everybody would loan everybody copies or beta tapes and things like that. And we sat down and we all watched it as a family. And my brother was too little. He didn't really have any interest. He moved on. He's 3 years younger than me. But I watched it. And, man, this movie, it stuck with me for a good chunk of my life. It's just a creepy movie. It's just a really creepy movie. And as I'm older now and I revisit it, I realized that one of the reasons why it's so creepy is not just so much the creatures, but it's the performances of the actors, Darby, but also the actor that plays her husband, I forget his first name, but I know his last name's Hutton. I know he's Timothy Hutton's dad. I know that.
Yeah, James Hutton, right.
There we go. As I get older now, some of these regular things we see in films now, you know, that we didn't really pay attention to when we were kids. I mean, I see these things now, the misunderstood wife, the husband's like, you know, move on, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Some of the scariest stuff to me now is, you know, that in Darby's performance, that nobody believes her. And I kind of like the way she pulls that off in this film. The film is still just creepy. I mean, I'm not scared of mice, but I don't dig them. I don't like little things at all. sounds like a bizarre thing to say. Somebody's going to steal that for an audio clip somewhere.
How do you look at your penis then is what we need to ask ourselves.
Yeah. But you know, the film still works even after all this time. Now, I haven't seen the remake. I have no interest. I'm one of these kind of guys who I don't really care about remakes. They don't bother me. But if it's a film I really like, I just typically am not interested in seeing a remake. So I just don't really care about the remake because I've always had an affection for this film and the power that it has, considering it was made for TV.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm totally cool with, you know, totally admitting any conversation about the remake. I think it's sort of a ridiculous premise. So I'm not a fan of even discussing the remake. I haven't seen the remake, and I'm sort of going to take a stance and not see it. It's
right.
So damn impressive about Don't Be Afraid of the Dark is the impact that it's had on its fans. You know, like, I'm a little bit different. I didn't see this film until probably around 2002, 2003. Okay. And it was for the first time just me renting it at a video store. I had heard so much about it, and it had one of those covers that kind of, you know, sticks out to you on a video store shelf. And what's really fascinating about that too is, you know, for a TV movie and having that cover of that image of Kim Darby on it, it's sort of an iconic image in horror. If you think about it, you know, it's always, you know, it's, if you think of Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the first thing that I always think of is that image of her against the wall with the curtains down, holding her hand over her mouth in fear. And that's pretty cool. You know, it's really cool that a TV movie, you know, has created sort of this iconic imagery. You know, going back to what I said a second ago about the fan bases, if you spend time, you know, looking up the film, researching it online, you're going to find just a plethora of reviews about the film. And it's really cool is how no matter what, you know, what website you're on or what review you're reading, all the reviews, 99.9% of the reviews always start out with that reviewer writing, this is where I saw this for the first time, and this is the impact it had on me, blah, 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 here's the review.
Right.
And I mean, that's a pretty interesting testament to the power of the film that it's had such an impact on people, you know, and they're still writing about it, you know, some 30 years later. It's pretty impressive.
No, it is. It's very impressive. I always think, when I think of Kim Darby, and once I realized that we were doing these Kim Darby films, because, you know, we joked about that last time, I often think of her, the first two films that always come to mind for me are True Grit and this film.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
I mean, they're both like iconic roles for her.
They're both very big roles. You know, this is what I like about Don't Be Afraid of the Dark versus True Grit is this was sort of, you know, in the landscape of her career, this was sort of, you know, the first, this was A, a departure for her, and B, this is a film that she's carrying on her shoulders. You know, other times, you know, she had had secondary roles, supporting roles, you know, something that True Grit, obviously she's supporting someone much larger than herself, someone that's larger than life, John Wayne. And right. Here she is the star. You know, this is her film. It's her film. It's her story to guide to the end. And so I think that's what people what makes the film so cool is that A, it's her in this role, but B, it's sort of this, you know, women's liberation horror film, which, you know, you have the hero, basically a heroine, and, you know, is a female going through a whole horror film and actually having to resolve the conflict, but even though there is no resolution, but you have her guiding us through the film, and there's no male lead stepping in to sort of, don't worry, honey, I'll save you.
Right.
And that's
right, because,
really cool.
Yeah, because, the husband character, the Jim Hutton character, you know, he's so obsessed with his career. It's a lot of stuff we still see now in cinema and in life. I mean, he's so obsessed with his career and everything. He thinks his wife's gone, you know, a little loopy and stuff. And there's those great, I like those great scenes where it's like, you know, it's like the old adage that where, the, you know, she sold her soul to the devil. She's got this comfortable life and she doesn't really have to work. But at the same time, she, you know, she's worried about things. But then their friend's like, you know, come on, let's go spend our husband's money. You know, there's like this swap you give in life. But yeah, she's, you know, it is like very much like female empowerment. But at the same time, it's like, you know, it's like that balancing act. It's like right when things were changing, you know.
I know this is none of my business, but is everything all right?
You mean between Alex and me?
Yes.
It's fine. It's just that...
What?
Alex is at a stage in his life where all he thinks about is his job and getting ahead. What really scares me is that it may not be a stage. Maybe it's permanent.
You think so?
I don't know. It's just the possibility of partnership. That's terribly important to him. That's all he thinks about.
Well, isn't that understandable?
It's just most of the time I feel like a reasonable adjunct to his getting ahead.
Join the club.
What does that mean?
You forget who I'm married to. George Kahn. Better known in the plastics business as Genghis Kahn.
You're kidding, George?
Dear old quiet George. I'm afraid I know rather well what it's like to be left by yourself, to brood. Also, I'm very good at making emotional mountains out of imaginary molehills.
Then you think last night was imaginary?
You want me to be honest?
Yes, go ahead.
I think that's exactly what it was. So as two neglected wives of two overly ambitious husbands, I suggest we go spend some of their money.
So how did you come to get cast in Don't Be Afraid of the Dark?
Just offered. Just offered to me. That is a... That is that I am so fat in that movie. That is me coming off amphetamines for 18 years, and I have about 2 weeks sobriety, and I can hardly hold my head up. But my work is good.
It's incredible, and it's the first time where you're physically carrying a whole film on your shoulders too.
I'm very centered.
So what attracts you to that idea? Like, I mean, up to that point, you really hadn't done anything in the horror or fright genre. I mean, you had done sci-fi with The People, you know, the Coppola-produced TV movie. But, I mean, like, what was appealing to you about this project?
Needed the bucks.
So, I mean, where was it filmed?
I just happened to pick one that was really scary, I guess. And I was really, really focused.
You know, going back to what you said earlier, this film has a very primal aesthetic to it. Like, you know, it's playing on your childhood fears. You know, it's playing on what's in the dark, the creepiness of empty spaces, the fear of the unknown, you know, like just the power of imagination kind of stuff. And you know, the inspiration for the film, you know, if you do some research, was exactly that. You know, the screenwriter of the film, he, you know, he went off and was living in Spain at some, for some time, and he was at like his family's home, and he remembered, you know, he was trying to come up with something to do project-wise, and he remembered his own childhood fears of this old deep fireplace that he had had to clean as a child, you know, and in fact, what's really cool about that too is the writer of the film, he actually is the guy who does the creature voices. Those whispers in the film.
Yeah, and it is pretty cool. And I do know that the writer of this, I know he wrote a bunch of episodes of The Waltons, a show I watched a lot growing up. Has nothing to do with this film, but that's all I know him from. I looked him up when I would started watching the film. And I was like, well, you know, I'm looking at the writer. I'm doing a little research. And I remember thinking, you know, where have I seen that name before? And it was on episodes of The Waltons.
You know, this film was shot in 2 to 3 weeks for ABC. You know, it aired on ABC on Wednesday, October 10th, 1973. And the damn impressive thing about it is the fact that it had over 12 million viewers when it came out. Now, I've been trying, I haven't been successful, but I've been trying to figure out sort of like the inflation rate in terms of like what that would be today. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine like in 1973, 12 million viewers was just massive.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And it played in theaters in Europe as well. You know, I can see how it had this impact on eventually what would become this generation of horror fans, and that's why I think the film still lasts today.
Yeah, and we should say it's a very, very crisp 74 minutes long.
It's a very breezy 74 minutes long. Yeah,
I mean, I'd forgotten how short the film was because it's packed with so much stuff in its brief 74 minutes.
One of the most wonderful aspects of the film for me is this sort of, you know, old dark house idea. You know, the house is very much a character in the film, you know, and it's just chewed up to hell, you know, with Darby and Hutton running through. There's scenes in every room. They're running back and forth through this room and that room. And more importantly, the thing that you know, makes the film cool, but also it's really beautiful to look at. You know, there's all these incredible colors. You know, the colors, there's like a color pattern that runs through this film. You know, it starts out with blues, and it goes to greens and yellows and reds. And, you know, I hate to say it, but it's got a very, you know, Italian horror atmosphere to it. In a way, you know, just those color patterns, and there's a contrast of colors. You see like shots of one room that's blue, and then the background you'll see another shot that's green, and right. You know, that room's green. That's really cool. And there's also that, you know, great Italian aesthetic, which is, you know, the climax of the film. You have the creatures, you know, trying to get her, and they've cut the power to the house, and you have all the windows in the house opening, and the wind's blowing through, and the curtains are standing at attention. You know, it's very, very Argento in its way.
Yeah, it's very, I agree with you. One of my notes was it's very, you know, old dark house, but it's also very, you know, very 70s, very Argento-esque in a lot of ways. It's like the filmmaker, you know, saw a couple influences, you know, and you know, saw that, and he was kind of influenced by some of that Italian horror cinema. Which is very nice. I had actually forgotten about those little touches.
Yeah, absolutely. It really makes it stand out. I mean, I can't think of any other made-for-TV movies because, you know, I'm such an aficionado in made-for-TV movies, but there just wasn't anything that came out in this time frame. Like, maybe you had, like, Bad Ronald, you know, because that was a really, really influential TV film, but nothing stands out in terms of the visuals that you have in Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. And that's, I think, what's helped the film stand the test of time as well. And also, I think, again, you know, not to beat a dead horse, but we have Kim Darby, you know, and I'll just go on record and I'll say that I think this performance of hers, it's very big. And, you know, I think it was very taxing on her because you have a situation where you have your main character having to constantly stay in this sort of state of fear. And I'm sure I'll get some flack for this, but I sort of equate this performance to the performance of Shelley Duvall in The Shining, because, you know, that too is a situation where, and you know, that story is famously documented where you have, you know, her kind of freaking out, getting stressed out because she had to stay in this constant state of fear. And that's great that Kim Darby also has to stay in that constant state of fear. And I think that's great. And I think that's what makes the film work. You know, your character is, you know, in this constant state of fear. You know, I mean, how did you get there internally? Like, are you thinking about something particular to get there?
Well, John Newland, the director I'd worked with before, so if I needed something off stage, I'm very sensitive to hearing. So if I needed something off stage, he might give me more. He might have a crew member drop something when I just ask for, you know, him to hit a piece of furniture or something. And I know where the look is. I'll ask for something.
Brings you back to our favorite room.
I finished the living room bookcases and figured I'd bring my paint cans and brushes down here out of the way. You shouldn't have opened it up, Mrs. Farnham.
Well, I guess my curiosity got the better of me.
In future, you'd be better off leaving it alone.
Mr. Harris, you're as bad as I am, letting your imagination run away with you.
Why, has something happened?
No. What would happen? Anyway, you're quite right about the fireplace. My husband and I both looked at it, and it would be impossible to open it up.
That's what I told you, but you wouldn't listen.
Mr. Harris, I'm a perfect woman, stubborn and curious. Would you like a cup of coffee?
No, thank you, Mrs. Farnham. I've got to be getting along. Thank you.
Watch you, Sally.
You know, where was it filmed? I mean, was the house a set?
No, it was a real house. It was, I think, I don't know if it's there still, but I think it was one of those houses that was way back in the day. I don't think it's there now. It was a kind of Hollywood house that was used for movies and things. Maybe just the outside was. I think just the outside was. And the inside was inside a studio somewhere.
When you're first offered it in your cast, can you remember any script changes or differences versus what you read versus the shooting script? Because I know there were some changes. So do you remember? I mean, I kind of remember that reading an article with the original writer said he wasn't very happy with the film or the script because someone had changed it on him or something. Do you remember reading any differences from what was shot?
No. I know on a lot of television things, they have, you know, blue pages come in, yellow pages come in. There's quite a few different colors, but I don't remember anything significant. It was a long time ago.
And you shot the whole thing in like 2 weeks, right?
Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, you know, going back to what I talked about earlier about, you know, how you're carrying this film, like, I mean, was that something that you adjusted to easy, or I mean, were you like in your element? Were you like, was it in, you know, feeding your ego, or I mean, was that something difficult to do for you to carry a whole film, or do you just not realize it while you're doing it?
I never realized when I was doing it. It was just part of my work. I didn't realize. 2 weeks, maybe it was 2 weeks. It seems like it was three weeks. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. It's arguably one of the best lead performances by a female in a horror film, I think, of all time. That's my opinion. I mean, I don't know. You know, we got what we have called scream queens, but this isn't so much a scream queen role. It's just one of the best performances I've seen by a female lead in a horror film. And just revisiting it this time, it just reminds me again how good Kim Darby was. I mean, you know, you've basically returned me on to Kim Darby.
Well, listen, I've done my job. We can stop the show now then.
let's not do that. I could talk about all Kim Darby's work. Let's just keep
talking. Right. Yeah. You know, one thing I want to point out about the film too is it's a TV movie, and you have, you know, you won't have a traditional narrative here. You have, you know, normally, like I mentioned earlier, you would have, well, A, you have a heroine in, you know, what could be a male lead role, but also you have a very non-traditional film in the sense that, you know, normally in any film you have, you know, conflict, resolution, and then go home. And here there is no resolution. You know, it's a very grim outlook. You have a lead character that doesn't know how to fight back against these tormentors, and you know, you think that, oh well, gee, she's gonna figure out how to save herself or how to kill these creatures, and she doesn't, and we don't know what happens to her, and the house got her, and that's got to be, you know, incredibly ahead of its time for 1973, and on a Hollywood level or a movie, a general film level, but B, for on a TV level as well. You know, you can't, I can't think of anything that came out in that era that would have had such, you know, such an inventive idea for a story and a resolution for a story for that matter.
Right.
You know, that's so cool.
I was going to say the only other film of this era that I can think of that's comparable for the impact might be the made-for-TV film might be. I sometimes think Trilogy of Terror is right in there. I like this more than Trilogy of Terror, but it kind of reminds me, you know, of what the kind of films they were, you know, America was making on TV. That, you know, unfortunately, we don't get that kind of stuff anymore, right? And I don't know how familiar you are with Trilogy of Terror, but
right, yeah, no, I've seen it, and every time someone mentions Trilogy of Terror, for some reason, I get this strange bubble that pops in my head, and I say Stephen King's Cat's Eye, and I dust off Stephen King's Cat's Eye and go to it, you know.
Yeah,
it's like,
nice.
Got to see that little creature on the record player going around.
Nice. Yeah. I think I'm going to rip out Cat's Eye. I have that, and I haven't watched that in forever. Thanks,
nice.
Man.
Yeah. You know, so let's talk about the creatures, you know, because I like going back to what I just said a second ago, it's never explained, you know, what are these creatures? Why are they in the house? You know, how do you stop them? How do you get rid of them? You know, there's just no resolution. They're just there. And, you know, there's some hinting, some inkling of, you know, how they got there, what they're doing there, why they're there. You know, obviously they want Kim Darby, but, you know, it's never really explained. And I really like that. I mean, I like that it's left up to the imagination. That's the coolest thing for me about this film. And I'll beat it to a pulp here. That's why this film works. That's why it still remains scary.
Yeah. I have to ask, you know, I don't know if you've, I haven't done the research to find out, but are the characters based on anything that you know, the creatures? Are they based on anything? They have a very organic feel.
One of the funnest aspects of the film is the fact, you know, that your character is always, you know, running or hiding or, you know, from these little creatures, but you're never actually in a two shot with them. You know, like every time we see him, it's always a cutaway. Do you know, like, it was a low budget project, right? Like, can you talk a little bit about, like, some of the restraints that has on you as an actor? Like, I mean, sure, you're sensitive to sound, but like, how are you reacting to these creatures that you're not seeing?
Well, those creatures were real people. They were different than small people, and they couldn't have their costumes on too long because their lung capacity wasn't good. So I'm surprised there was never a two shot.
You know, one thing that's really cool too that I want to talk about, and I just, you know, I didn't notice this until recently. I went back and obviously I've watched Don't Be Afraid of the Dark about 20 times in the last couple months now, and one thing I didn't notice, and I just, as I'm preparing for today's show, I started to see this sort of quasi parallel with Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, and Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell. Do you know what I'm saying? Because, like, if you think about how the film, how those, you know, obviously they're about different things, but the structure and the outcome, and eventually the fact that, you know, in Drag Me to Hell, you have a gypsy taking, you know, wanting to drag this girl back to hell because this curse. But you also have these, in Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, you have these creatures with no reason. They just want Kim Darby, they want her soul, and they're going to drag her back.
Yeah.
And films end very similar, you know?
Yeah, I didn't really think about that, but you're right. You know, obviously. Either Raimi, you know, is a fan of this film, which I've never really read if he is, but I would assume he might be. But yeah, they are very similar in some ways.
Right. And I'm not proud of the fact that I made this parallel because I'm not a fan of Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
But it just struck me really oddly. You know, it struck me very odd that this parallel was sort of in place here. And by the way, speaking of, you know, just in case you haven't seen Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, this film, you know, it ends with the creatures, you know, finally getting to Kim Darby and dragging her across the house and into the fireplace, and she's gone forever. And, you know, what's sort of really cool about that scene is if you go back and watch the scene when they're dragging her across the floor, she's trying everything she can while being under the influence of sleeping pills, you know, to save herself. She's sort of being dragged in this sort of Christ-like posture, you know, right. Like her arms are kind of stretched out like she's resting on the crucifix. And I have to wonder if there's some sort of inspiration there, because you have that aspect and you also have, you know, the fact that they're trying to get her soul, like maybe she's some, you know, religious figure and they're after her, you know, right. That's kind of a cool aspect that you know, doesn't really get pointed out, if it should. You know,
yeah, I mean, I can see that angle. I mean I didn't really pick it up, but I can see that angle. I think what I like most about that is that we know she's been taken, but she's still conscious of the fact that she's been taken. Like, she's asking questions, like, you know, like, basically, what do we do now? You know, like the last couple of lines of the film, you know?
Yeah, and she can't get away. She's sort of completely helpless, you know, intervening of her husband and her friend. You know, it's sort of like she was doing her best to stay out of the situation, trying to, you know, remedy the situation. And it's her undoing ultimately that's caused by her husband.
Right, right.
So that's kind of a really cool aspect about it. And speaking of the husband, you know, you mentioned him earlier, James Hutton, you know, playing Kim Darby's husband here. And he, of course, like you mentioned, was the father of actor Timothy Hutton. He actually passed away not too long after the making of the film. I believe he had gotten cancer.
Right.
What's really interesting about it, too, is he wasn't the director's first choice. Like, they originally wanted the great tanned one, George Hamilton, in the role. I mean, can you imagine? Like, I would not be cool with seeing Miss Darby smooching on that Love at First Bite mole, would you?
Yeah. There's something about George Hamilton that's always been kind of sleazy to me. I don't know what it is, man. Like, some actors play sleazy and some actors are just sleazy, and Hamilton just seems sleazy to me.
It would have made a mockery of, I think, of this film. Would have made it a true TV movie if we had cast Hamilton
right.
in it, you know.
Right.
He said that after he put the bolts back in the ash door and came upstairs with you, he never touched them again. Doesn't know anything about the key either. He also said we could find ourselves a new carpenter.
Why?
He's embarrassed, obviously. The man feels guilty.
Well, I can't say that I'm sorry. He's a very good worker. It's just that dictatorial attitude of his. But I don't think he did anything.
Well, who did?
I don't know. That's what scares me.
Sal, I know you're under a lot of pressure. The next couple of days are very important. We've got the dinner party tomorrow night, and I'm depending on you.
I know.
And this is absurd anyway. All these little creatures running around, calling your name and grabbing a hold of your dress.
But after the party, you'll be gone.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be gone 2 days, but only one night.
You worked with James Hutton. What was that like?
A dream, just a dream, the sweetest great man.
Yeah, one of the strangest, you know, the things about the film that, you know, you look, which you are, of course, you know, you're so much younger than, like, the actor James Hunt who's playing your husband. Like, was that something that seemed out of the ordinary to you as you were working on it?
Never.
It's always what people, like, point out when you read, like, anything about the film.
I just, The only thing that bothered me was I felt strangely terrible because I was, you know, for me, dealing with my weight, you know. But I'll say that I was sure, focused.
You know, there's another element here at play that's sort of, you know, I think people need to be conscious of, and that ties in again to that whole playing into the audience, you know, the childhood fears of the audiences. You know, there really needs to be that element, you know, where you have that suspension of disbelief, you know, to really get into this film. I mean, it's very dark, and there's a lot of great tension here in the film, and it's eerie, and the music is just so effective. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I got to tell you, there is that aspect where, like, if, you know, if this doesn't hit that childhood fear for you, I can sort of see, like, you know, where it is, it could be easy to get, you know, some laughs out of it, you know, because there are right. these elements here that sort of make it sort of humorous. Just, you know, the fact that it had a low budget, you know, sort of put some limitations on the film. You have the creatures whispering, you have the shower scene, you know, which, by the way, had to have been somewhat sort of racy for television back in 1973, because we're getting, you know, some of Ken Darby's backside there. And,
right.
and then you have the brilliance of the colors in that scene as well, which I really like. But, mm-hmm. you know, also in that scene, you have the creatures reaching out from the towel cupboard with a coat hanger, you know, trying to shut off the light in the room, like, you know, he's trying to break into a car. you
yeah,
know, and
yeah.
that's, it's kind of funny if you think about it. Like, if, you know, if you weren't in the right frame of mind checking this film out, you know, then it could be like, oh my God, this is sort of silly. So damn eerie and creepy, you know. It's got all these great colors in it, and you know, and there's that shower scene too, which I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about. So, you know, was that? I mean, did you consider that to be edgy? Because I mean, it was kind of. Wasn't that kind of edgy for television? I mean,
I guess it was. I can only barely remember it.
I can remember it. How's that?
Okay.
And then
scary.
No. is there any collaboration? Like, I mean, so you're working at this breakneck pace, you know? So, I mean, is there like a collaboration on a project like this? Are you allowed, you know, to contribute ideas to the Sally character, or like what she does? Like, I mean, is that possible working in television like this?
I didn't at all. Maybe that's why I was hired, because I had worked with John Newland before, and maybe they knew that I knew how to hit the mark and get the lines out, and I guess I was good.
What I like about that shower scene is I like the way that they decide to shoot it, where they have these moments where she sees the creatures, and there's like this pause to the creature's behavior. They're like, oh shit, she's seen us. But she's like, no, she's seen us. But the way they shoot it, it's almost like, is she under the spell of medication? You know, what's going on? Because she's kind of reacting slow. It's like she believes it, but she can't believe it. It's like, you know, Darby really pulls that off really well. And the way it's shot is pretty masterful, because I like those scenes where she's kind of, you know, opening the cupboard stuff. It really builds tension really well. And this filmmaker, you know, wasn't really known for a whole lot, not that I'm aware of. Mostly TV, I believe. But I think those scenes are really very well handled. And I really like her performance in those moments, because instead of just screaming when she immediately sees one, you know, because she's already had these moments with these creatures, she's like, wow, this is what I'm dealing with. It's almost like she's scared, and yet now she's got to figure out how to deal with them at the same time. And it's pretty smart. It's pretty good filmmaking, actually. The way it's handled, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. This is like a huge, like I said, it's a huge performance for her, and I don't think this film would have been as good without her, to be honest with you. And you know, it's if you're right on key right there, you know, talking about the hesitation, because that's what's so cool about it, is you have that element there, which is like, are these creatures even real? You know, is this all in her head? You know, her husband thinks she's imagining things. She thinks she might be imagining things.
Right.
You know, that's really cool. And, you know, a really funny aspect of that is mentioning, you know, that shower scene. And even later on that, you know, you have, or maybe earlier on, when I think about the dinner scene, because the film is low budget, you never ever have, if you notice and go back and look at the film, you never have a two shot with Darby and the creatures in the same shot.
Yeah.
So you usually have Darby, her reaction, cut to the creature's face going, huh? or I'm going to get you. You know, you never have them in the same frame together, which, you know, is obviously the situation with budget. But it works. It just totally works. I mean, I'm conscious of it because, again, there's that aspect that, like, well, you know, people could kind of construe that as kind of sort of goofy and kind of silly, you know, but I think it works. I think it's, you know, I buy into that primal childhood fear aesthetic. And so, you know, even at, you know, 35 years old, I watch this film and it's still sort of, it's very eerie and it's very scary. And if I can get into it, the tension is really incredible. And I'm really on edge when I'm watching the film, even if I've seen it. I've seen it 20 times now, so I still get that feeling from it, that response.
It's also, I agree with you, it's the budget, and it's also the fact that you have full-grown actors, and they probably had to build these sets, right? These sets for, you know, where you have these miniature creatures, so they had to build these extra-large sets.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Because the house was actually real, according to Kim, which, you know, you heard in the show with her in the interview. But yeah, you know, they had to build large phones, large candles, large books, large coat hangers.
Yeah, I mean, there's something kind of quaint about that type of cinema, though. I've always liked that. I've always liked the idea of, you know, somebody building these large chairs or a large phone or, like you say, a large coat hanger. I always liked that. You know, I can't imagine those meetings. Like, what we need, guys, is we need a really big coat hanger. Big coat hanger.
Yeah, and it's really cool because it's a throwback to, like, the old 50s, you know, horror films like The Incredible Shrinking Man or, you know, stuff like that where you had matte shots or you had, you know, rear projection of the, you know, for example, there's that great shot in The Incredible Shrinking Man of him and, like, the loincloth staring and the cat, the giant 60-foot cat is staring at him, which is like a rear projection shot. You had him, you know, climbing up or even as something simple as like Doll Man. Remember Doll Man? From
19- oh, yeah.
So, yeah, you had those miniatures, those, you know, enlarged items being built for a film like that as well. And that's so cool just because it is an homage, you know, back to those films of the good old days. You know, there's some other standout performances here I want to also, you know, on top of Ken Darby and James Hutton, we have, of course, you know, we have little person actor Felix Silla in place here as one of the creatures. And, you know, I got to say, I'm actually a huge fan of Felix Silla. You know, he's pretty much did everything over the last 40 years. You know, he was in Planet of the Apes, you know, Star Wars. He played Tweaky and Buck Rogers. He was Cousin Id in the Addams Family. You know, he's just had this incredible career. And if you track his career, you know, because I'm more interested in seeing him without a costume on or without some sort of makeup effect going on. Like, I'm not sure if you've seen a film. There's two films that I really like that he's in as just himself. And one is Little Cigars, for example.
Never seen Little Cigars. Always meant to.
Yeah. And then he's really great in She Freak, where he's running around with a cowboy hat on trying to stab Jade actress, you know, Claire Brennan. Yeah. And I love me some She Freak like no one else. So
yeah, there's actually two films of his I do adore as well. Well, a couple. I like The Manitou, and he's in that. And he's
William Gurley,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And he's in Black Samurai, which is an awful movie, but I love it anyway. It's a Jim Kelly film.
Yeah.
And of course, he's in Under the Rainbow. I don't know if you're a fan of Under the Rainbow or not, but I quite like that film.
Yeah, I have a really love-hate relationship with that film. It's and it played in theaters too. Did you know it played in theaters in Europe?
I hadn't know. Maybe I did because people would write me. Yeah.
Also, there's in the film is a great cameo by William Sylvester, who is also, of course, you know, he was Haywood Floyd in 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yes, indeed.
That's great. And then you have William Demarest. You know, he plays our you know, our old man Scooby Doo. Stay away from that old house caretaker, and he's really great here as well.
I have my way of looking at things, and you and your wife have yours. And it's like I said before, I think there are some things that shouldn't be taken lightly.
What about this house? Why don't we stop all that nonsense?
I don't call it nonsense.
All right, superstition.
And I don't call it superstition
either.
Well,
then what do you call it?
I don't have a name for it, but I wouldn't call it either one of those things.
Look, Mr. Harris, I don't want to get in another beef with you. And I don't mean to offend you, sir. But I don't happen to believe in all that stuff.
I know you don't. But it might be better for you and Mrs. Farnham if you did.
Well, that's where you're wrong. Because she's quite frightened enough already as it is. And I've got to hold you partly responsible for that.
I only warned her.
Yeah, to the extent that she wants to sell this place.
Sell it?
That's right. We're moving. I'd appreciate it if you give me a couple of weeks' work. You know, it needs fixing up.
I'm afraid not, sir. and I'm sorry if I scared you.
I didn't say anything. I didn't tell him anything.
Why did you tell?
And you know what happens to people who tell, don't you?
But I didn't. I didn't tell. I just warned him, that's all.
Yes, you don't.
Hey, what do you remember him the most from? I remember him the most from My Three Sons, but that's just me personally.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, but I mean, I do remember him from that show, but I did some research on him and looking back, and I mean, this is an actor. Like, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark was sort of like one of his last pieces of work. Like, he had been acting as early as like the 30s.
Yeah. He's intense. He's like one of those character actors that like pops up. If you go back and like look at movies from the 50s and stuff, chances are you're probably going to, he's going to pop up in some films from the 40s and 50s. If you're just watching any random movie from the 40s and 50s, he'll probably pop up at some point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That guy, that's an amazing career. I mean, if I was an actor on Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, I would be tapping him for all kinds of crazy stories.
Yeah, exactly.
So listen, let's wrap this up. So what are your final thoughts on Don't Be Afraid of the Dark?
I think Don't Be Afraid of the Dark is a very, it's a great horror film. It's not the type of horror film that, you know, It's not for gore fans or something like that, but you know what it is? I thought about this after watching it. You know, my son, he's only 19 months old, but when he gets to be like 7 or 8 years old, I think this film would be very good horror film, like a good starter horror film for young kids, because it's intense, but it's not too intense, and it's well crafted and it's short. So, you know, for kids, that's very critical. But I think this film holds up extremely well. I was actually surprised. I'll be honest with you, when I started watching this, I was like, I've seen this before. I've seen it more than a handful of times. I bet I've seen it 10 or 15 times. I know the beats. I know what it does and everything else. But you know what? I got sucked right back into it. And the next thing I knew, it was over. So this film holds up extremely well. I would definitely recommend Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Yeah, me too. You know, it's one of those great things where you don't have to, you know, if you're listening and you know, you're not a horror nut, you know, you can, it's a film that you can sort of jump into, because it while it works on a horror level, it also works just sort of on a great, you know, a mystery level, and it also works on sort of like this nostalgic, you know, ode to classic, you know, sci-fi and horror films of the 50s. And I really like that about it. And, you know, it's also sort of this, you know, actors movie. And you have this brilliant performance by Kim Darby, which for me is, you know, to pick up the film is worth the price alone just to see her in this film.
Right.
Look how iconic it is too. Like, everyone remembers this movie, and everyone, if the cool thing about this movie is, like, if you go on the internet and read about it, any review, the person writing there, if you always mentions right off the bat the first where they were when they first saw this, or what the impact was on them when they saw it. So,
wow.
I mean, are you impressed by that? I mean, it's got a strange legacy. Does that surprise you? Are you impressed by a legacy like that? Are you proud to be part of something that
That's really great.
All right, so that's all we have time for this week. Be sure to listen next week for Sam and I in the final show of the series dedicated to Kim Darby. You know, we'll be taking a look at the wonderful 1978 Carl Reiner-directed goofball comedy, The One and Only. For more information on Kim Darby, please visit kimdarby.com, and please take a look at what was the culmination of 4 hours I spent with Kim back in January via a massive print interview retrospective on her career over at mondovideo.com. Now, if you grab the Mondo Film Podcast today on iTunes or from mondofilmpodcast.com, please do me a huge one and leave the show some feedback and a rating, and visit our official other outlets, Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker Radio, and any other places where fine podcasts are sold. And of course, I didn't forget, to hear more of Sam and his partner in crime, Large William, be sure to go over and check out the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema podcast at ggtmc.com and tell him that Large Marge sent you. All right, man, round three. Are you feeling okay? Do you need a good cut man in your corner?
I'm feeling good.
Your next game called Wreck-A-Sucking for the Lake. king of darkness.